Thanks very much. So this is a bit of a change from the abstract that got sent around originally, but what I want to talk about is putting limits on the computational power of different physical systems. So there's already been a lot of work done into what sets of gates are universal for computation and things like that. And I want to look at systems that aren't universal, but where maybe there's some subspace that you can do universal computation on. Okay, so basically I wasn't really sure what the makeup of the audience would be, so I thought I'd talk about the motivation for doing this first, and then briefly fly through the stabilizer formalism, just in case anyone's not familiar with it. And then I'm going to talk about how we can use that to come up with a way of putting upper limits on the number of usable qubits in a physical system. And then I thought I'd finish with some examples. Okay, so basically the reason that I've come to look at this problem is that I've been doing a lot of work in global control, where you're using the same rotation on every qubit or something similar to that, where you only have a finite number of controlled Hamiltonians, and that doesn't scale with the size of your system. So it turns out that if you have something like a spin chain, and you can control the ends of the chain here and here, and you can do global rotations, and you've got some interaction, it's universal for quantum computing. Now, that may not be particularly interesting on its own, but what's more interesting is that certain pretty similar networks aren't universal, like this one, for example. So if we have a state across here that's 1, 0, -0, 1, on these two spins, there's no global rotation that's going to get you out of that. And no Hamiltonian, if these two couplings are the same, and these two are the same, will get you out of that state. But you can still do universal quantum computing in that system. It's just that you have a smaller number of usable qubits. So that's going to be basically the gist of my talk. Sure.
If you have a long string of those, then wherever that sort of diamond shape appears, then you don't have a usable qubit.
Yeah. It turns out that these two qubits you can use as a qubit on its own, but there's one state that you can't access.
Okay.
Where if you start with that state, then you can't get out of it. And that effectively cuts the chain in half. Okay. So,
most of the tools I'm going to use for this rely pretty heavily on the stabilizer formalism. So I thought I'd just run through that quickly. I'm not sure about in Canada, but in Ireland we call these training wheels stabilizers. That's why the bike's there. Okay, so a stabilizer is some operator, yes, that when you apply it to some quantum state, gives you the quantum state back. So here we have S as a stabilizer of the state psi, because psi is the plus one eigenvalue, or plus the eigenvector with plus one eigenvalue. So there's just some examples here. Like the Pauli operator Z stabilizes the zero state, minus Z stabilizes one, X stabilizes the plus state, which is just 0 plus 1, and minus X stabilizes 0 minus 1. Okay. So the next thing we want is to talk about subspaces rather than individual quantum states. So I'm just going to call, I'm going to say that a subspace is stabilized by S if every vector in that space is an eigenvector of S with eigenvalue plus one. Is that okay? So, for example, the operator Z1, Z2, which is just the Pauli Z operator tensored with itself, stabilizes the even parity subspace of two qubits. And minus Z1, Z2 will stabilize the odd parity subspace. So any state psi of this form will be stabilized by ZZ.
It turns out that stabilizers obey several rules. If you add two stabilizers of a particular state together, what you get is another stabilizer of that state or of that subspace. The same goes for multiplication. You can multiply two stabilizers together and still have another stabilizer of that space. And the last one is we can take the exponential of a stabilizer. And if we multiply it by some phase, we have another stabilizer of that space. Okay. So if we have stabilizers, we want to see how they evolve, because we're going to use them to, well, in general, you can use them to track the way quantum states evolve. So if we have some state psi prime, and it undergoes some unitary evolution given by u, then the new stabilizer of the state that comes from s prime is going to be given by u s prime u dagger. That's pretty easy to see why, because we can just expand out psi prime and have u psi, and then because u dagger u is the identity, we can insert this and we get the desired stabilizer. Okay, the last thing I'm going to say about stabilizers, I realize this isn't a full treatment, but I just wanted to give a quick run through of the basic properties. The last thing I'm going to say about stabilizers is about poorly grouped stabilizers. So a lot of the stabilizers that will come up in this are going to be operators in the Pauli group. It turns out that to identify a single qubit state, you need a single n qubit state. You need n Pauli operators. And if you want to identify a subspace of m qubits, you need n minus m stabilizers, or vice versa. Okay. So I wanted to I wanted to cover that quickly, and then to talk.
It has been suggested that there are computer scientists who think Hamilton is a desired type of sandwich. Not by me.
But that was a reference to Scott's point about the D wave. That, yeah.
But I would.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah, it's really hard to get a decent picture for Hamiltonians.
Picture of Hamilton.
Okay, so what I want to talk about
is to talk about the computational power of physical systems. And the way I'm going to parameterize a physical system is just by the set of operators you can perform on it. So these operators can be evolution under some Hamiltonian. So you've got some switch that turns on a laser and that gives some effect of Hamiltonian for some period of time. Or maybe projective measurements, or POVMs, or anything you want, or some other unitary operators. So maybe you have a linear optics setup, and you've got beam splitters. So you can't really apply the beam splitter you have for an arbitrary amount of time. I realize you can make different kinds of beam splitters, but I just thought I'd keep in unitary operators as a separate.
Assume that the set of operations that can be performed corresponds to a set of operators. I would expect super operators.
Sure. I mean, I'm considering unitary operations only.
So unitary operations and projective
yeah.
measurements.
Okay. So.
Okay. The first thing I want to. Talk about the first tool that we're going to have is we're going to talk about computational subspaces. And a computational subspace we're going to define to be any subspace in which you can do universal computation. So basically, it's any subspace in which you can realize any unitary operator on the states within that subspace. It turns out that, well, obviously, computational subspaces allow universal computation on that subspace. Any subspace of a computational subspace is itself a computational subspace. Okay, and an example of this is if you have a single photon in an M-mode array of linear optics. Turns out you can do any unitary on it. You can't change the number of photons, so you can't access every possible state that you could have in that system. But there is this single photon subspace that you can do universal computation on.
Efficiency here?
No, this is not.
Okay, so there must exist some sequence of operations that would give you any unitary, but we're not going to say anything about how long that might be.
Yeah, that's basically.
And when you say universal computation, you mean actually SUD.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be enough to have, say, SOD, even though that's computationally equivalent.
No. And so the idea is to find subspaces on which there's a subspace on which you can perform any unitary operator. That might correspond to some encoded subspace. Or,
The next thing we're going to have is a preparational subspace, which is basically any subspace in which you can take one quantum state to any other quantum state.
Okay, so you might start from zero state and you want to be able
to make it into any other state in that subspace. Now, obviously a state preparation is a special case of computation. So any computational subspace is also a preparational subspace. You can prepare any state within a computational subspace. But it's not necessarily true that it will be the other way around. Any computational subspace is going to be bounded in size by the size of the preparational subspace it sits in. And the size of the largest preparational subspace within a quantum system gives us an upper bound on the size of the largest computational subspace. So in order to find these subspaces, we're going to define some separation operator that I'm going to call D. And the property of D that's important is basically that when we operate on some state psi that sits in a computational subspace, that sits in a preparational subspace, it's going to have some eigenvalue epsilon sub psi. And it's going to be the same for all vectors within that subspace. So the subspace is an eigenspace of D. Okay, and it's easy to turn to get a stabilizer for the subspace from D because we just divide across by epsilon psi. Okay, and obviously this is true only if psi doesn't span multiple preparational subspaces. So,
multiple preparational subspaces.
Okay, so the subspaces are vector spaces. But you can think of, you can come up with a quantum state that's just a superposition of a state in one subspace and a state in another.
But any subspace of a preparational subspace would itself be a preparational subspace, right?
Yeah, sure.
So,
but that doesn't work on top of this.
Okay, but what you're requiring here is that the state, that there is a proportional subspace inside of which you can find all the supporting state.
Yeah, so.
But there will be other preparational subspaces that state in some sense pertains to, that we're not considering.
Yeah.
Is it easy to give an example?
Yeah, sure. So, an example of this idea of D. Is
where everything like the preparation.
Okay. Well, the preparational subspace. To be honest, I can't find any good examples of preparational subspaces that aren't computational subspaces.
Okay.
Except when it comes to certain measurement. schemes. But basically, a computational subspace. So you can think of a linear optics set, which has a whole lot of beam splitters, and you can arrange them any way you want. It has a lot of phase shifters, and you can arrange them any way you want. And you can put in you have single photon sources.
Okay, so the total. There's a subspace of the system that corresponds to zero photons, and it's only a single state. And there's a subspace that corresponds to one photon, and then two photons, and so on. Well, for linear optics, they do.
Yeah, sure. So, in principle, the full Hilbert space for all possible states you can have in the system is essentially infinite, because you can have as many photons as you want in the system. But you can't change the number of photons. So the computational subspaces are all a fixed photon number. So if you have a single photon in it, so for a single photon in an n-mode array, you can do any unitary operation you want. But this isn't the... but you can't. You can only do it within that subspace of a single excitation. You can't make one photon become two photons.
So that's one of your computational subspaces.
Yeah, exactly. And a preparational subspace is similar, except it doesn't require you to be able to do any unitary. It just requires you to be able to get from one state to another.
So, but is it, it's assumed that you're doing that in a unitary way, or is it okay to throw away the original state and then create the new state from scratch?
So you're...
I mean, that's usually how you'd be preparing, a case where you'd be able to prepare states but not necessarily do unitary, right?
You can throw... Well, it depends what operations you have available on the system. If you can reset qubits, then yes.
So I think Paul Kriyat had some experiments where, I'm not sure if he had a whole subspace, but there were a wide variety of photon states that he could create. But he wasn't doing unitary gates up there, it's just, you know, it was something he did on the laser output that would create these things. So that might be an example.
Another unitary example, I think, would be if you have a spin chain. But you only have, so you have something like an exchange interaction, and you've got local Z gates, then you can do local rotations if you want. You can't get any distribution of amplitude you want. You can only get the ones that are that you get by running the Hamiltonian for a certain amount of time and changing the phases. So there's certain states you can prepare without being able to do any arbitrary unitary operator that has that state as one of the operators. Is that okay? Okay,
so the idea is if we have psi after performing some operator on it. And for this, we don't really need them be unitary. I realize it's going to give you something out that's not a quantum state, but that doesn't really matter for the purposes of this. So the idea is that D is going to have to... So we can write psi t in terms of some operator times the initial state. And then, basically, by definition of our preparational subspace, we can translate d on psi t into omega sub j d on psi zero, just by going to the eigenvalue here, because it necessarily stabilizes this state. And then we just bring in the operator omega j. So this basically follows from the definition of d on the previous slide. Now, because this is true for all of the subspaces, we can pick vectors within each subspace to give us a complete basis. We don't need vectors that span subspaces. And if we do that, then if this holds for all of for all D, which it must by the definition of D, then it turns out that D has to commute with omega j. Okay. So the idea then is that for all omega j, which are all the operators we can apply to the system, we have a separation operator that has to commute with all of them. So if we can find some operator that does commute with all of them, then that's a valid separation operator. So the idea is then to get this separation operator, and we compute its eigenspectrum. So the largest eigenspace corresponds to the largest preparational subspace, and so puts an upper bound on the number of usable qubits within the system. Okay, and we can have a stabilizer for it just by dividing by the relevant eigenvalue. One thing this doesn't pick up is tensor product structures. So it is possible to have an operator D that satisfies this relationship that isn't, strictly speaking, a preparational, where the subspaces don't correspond to preparational subspaces. Because you can get from every state, well, you can form a basis, and you can get from each basis state to some other state, but in the same basis, but you kind of neglect entangled states. So you need to check that there's no tensor product structure on the operators you have, on the omega j's. But other than that, it's sufficient to give you the preparational subspaces. Okay. So that may have been a little bit abstract and a bit hard to follow, but I thought I'd go through some concrete examples. So the first is an example that everyone knows. It's linear optics. There's no new result in this bit. It's just to be to try to clarify the technique. So we can think of beam splitters that have that correspond to some operation that looks like this. And to phase plates that look like this. And we can think of them as being in some network. So you have some photons coming in here, and some photons coming in here. The phase plate does this to whatever photons come in here, and the beam splitter does this operation between the two modes coming in. Okay, so it turns out that, as I've already said a couple of times, that the total number operator, so the number of photons, the operator that gives you the number of photons, commutes with both of these. It also turns out that it commutes, well, pretty obviously, with a measurement of the total number of photons in any mode. So, basically this is just saying that you can't get from 7 photons to 3 photons with linear optics. And that's something that's well known, and basically. But I just thought it would be an example of how this works. So you look for some operator that commutes with all the operations you can perform on the system, and then you take the eigenspectrum of it. So in this case, you have an eigenspace that does increase exponentially, although that doesn't use the full Hilbert space of the system. And that's kind of the same as, well, it's actually, so this gives you an upper bound that's somewhat higher than you get for, say, the KLM proposal. in that it, the dual rail encoding keeps the same number of photons, which you'd expect. But because you only move photons between one of two modes, so you're essentially using them as a qubit, you don't necessarily use the full preparational subspace. Okay. So, as I said, the reason I had been looking at this is because I had been thinking about global control on spin networks, and I wanted to see the maximum number of usable qubits in a spin system. Because whenever you talk to experimentalists and you've worked out your global control scheme, it turns out the system they have is nothing like the system you want. And they say something along the lines of, oh, well, can you do anything with this system? And it's not obvious. Or maybe it is to some people. It's certainly not obvious to me. So the idea behind this was to be a tool that you could use to work out fairly quickly whether it was likely you could come up with a global control scheme or not. So the common interactions, I suppose, that you have tend to be the exchange coupling, where you have an overlap of wave functions, and it's just basically some coupling constant times sigma x, sigma x, sigma y plus sigma z, sigma z. So the jij here is just so it can be any coupling in a network. We can draw a graph that corresponds to our spin network, and each of the edges on the graph will be a coupling between two spins with some strength. And the same for the dipole coupling. Except here you have a different constant in front of the Z term. Well, it's just dictated by what way your magnetic field's oriented. And then the Ising coupling is just ZZ. Okay. So if we have local rotations about two axes, so we've got Hamiltonians that correspond to, say, sigma x and sigma y for a single qubit. So we can do rotations about the x and the y axis. Then it's obvious that no separation operator can commute with both of them, except for the identity. So the separation operator has to act as the identity on that qubit. So if we have local rotations on all the qubits about two axes, then this doesn't yield any interesting results. We know already that it's universal if you've got any coupling between them. And that kind of makes sense. So the first example, that's more of a real example, is the one I had in the motivation, which is where you have some network that has a piece that looks like this, where you've got two qubits that are connected identically to the rest of the graph. And they maybe have some interaction, that's xx plus yy plus zz, so that this coupling and this coupling are equal, and this coupling and this coupling are equal. And then you also need to be able to do, and then you're only allowed to do global rotations on these two spins. So you have to do the same rotation on both spins. So we can work out a separation operator, and it looks like this. It doesn't have to be ones, obviously, because you can rescale it. But the idea is that this gives you the eigenspectrum of this operator. You have three. You have a space of three vectors, of three orthogonal vectors, that correspond to the zero eigenvalue, and one that corresponds to the plus two eigenvalue, I think it is. So you've got one vector that you cannot change with these operations, and it just corresponds to, say, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. So global rotations don't do anything to that state. And neither, because we're affecting it in the same way on either side, no state we put on these qubits can change it either. So basically, what this is saying is that any system like this any part of a graph we come across that looks like this is a Q-trit. We can't get 2 qubits out of it no matter what we do, unless we've got local rotations. But that's kind of a specific example. I thought I'd have maybe some more general examples. So one of these can be the exchange interaction. If we have some network of spins, they could be on a surface or something, the wave function is overlapped, so you've got an exchange interaction between them. And it can be some arbitrary network. Yeah.
Doesn't the computational power of the central pair sort of depend on the initial state? That at most you get a Q-trit?
Yeah, that's exactly.
But you might start in a single cell.
Yes,
in which case you're stuck.
That's exactly. Okay, so then with the exchange interaction, you have some network of spins that are all coupled to each other with various coupling strengths by the exchange interaction, and you've got some set of Hamiltonians that give you local rotation. Sorry, global rotations. So you're doing the same rotation to every spin. It turns out that because this operator here, x on xj, because this is basically symmetric, these rotations don't give you anything.
So we can take the separation operator as this Hamiltonian here. So it turns out it's a valid separation operator. And so the size of the largest subspace is going to be given by first of all, this preserves the number of spins pointing in a particular direction, so the number of spin up and spin down qubits we have. The size of the largest subspace is going to be somewhere between n choose n over 2, which is roughly 2 to the n minus 1, and 1. And that just depends on our choice of couplings. But we can never use every qubit in the system. At most, we get to use half of them. Well, so somewhat less than half of them. And that requires a very very specific choice of jij. Of the coupling strengths in the network. And another example is something like an XXZ interaction. So we've got some interaction. This encompasses both the dipole interaction and the Heisenberg interaction. So we've got local Z rotations as well. And again, because the total number of spins pointing in any direction is preserved, we have this scaling again. So again, you can only use about half the qubits in the system. Same thing's true of systems where we have, for example, exchange interactions that we can switch on and off. So if we've local Z rotations, and we've got exchange interactions that we can turn on and off. Again, it's not universal. We can only use a subspace of that. Now, the reason I mentioned this one in particular is because this actually corresponds to a real proposal. And it doesn't seem to have been obvious that you cannot do universal computation in the system, that at most you're only able to use less than half the qubits. And we can go on. There's more examples, but you can have something like an Ising interaction and arbitrary X rotations. It turns out that's actually pretty good. You can have basically one qubit and then one buffer, so you can use half the spins in the system as well.
Yeah. this has been proposed as one of the biggest models that have been proposed. But you can't use all the qubits. But then if I've got a scalable system where I can use half the qubits, then, I mean, that's still a good,
yeah,
it's gonna work, right? I'm wondering if you can distinguish between non-universal in the sense of you can't use all the qubits and non-universal in the sense of it ain't gonna scale.
Yeah, so the problem is that the proposed system didn't use the half qubits that you can actually use. Which meant you couldn't do all that much at all. It's easy to see how to change
it. So it was proposed to use one of the other subspaces that's smaller, or?
Well, it looked like the set of gates they had drawn there would probably give you universal computation, and they don't. Because you're stuck in an excitation that has in a subspace that has a certain number of spin-up qubits, for example, mm-hmm. or spins.
And that subspace doesn't scale?
Oh, it does, actually. But you can't do universal computations in the way that's proposed. They thought they could do all single qubit gates as a special case of code. And it turns out you can't do that.
So, by the way, when you're listing these sizes of the largest subspace, you said this, those just upper bounds, or you can actually always get a computation
in
space that far?
If there is a... it's an upper bound. But there's certain conditions that, if they're satisfied, it should give you the correct number. Mm-hmm.
And in the examples you're giving, those are all satisfied? Or?
No, not in all of them. So you need it to be true that there's no tensor target structure on that space, which, for example, isn't true in the LPC space if you neglect measurements. So there's that condition, and then you need for the preparational subspace to correspond to a computational subspace. That doesn't always hold. There are no specific cases where it doesn't hold. It does hold most of the time. But the exact criteria are much better.
Okay, but I guess the underlying question is for these examples, the specific examples that you're showing, when you say the size of the largest subspace, there are some cases where you don't actually know you have one that large.
For this one, this is true, because, we've done experiments with that. This is also true. This is true. This is true. This one you don't necessarily have a subspace that size.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, but I think for all the cases I have, they do correspond to the size of the computational subspace. So that's basically it. I just wanted to basically talk about this way of finding an upper bound on the number of usable qubits in the system. So all you need to do is find some separation operator, some operator that can use what all of the Hamiltonians or other operations you plan to do to the system. And if you find that, compute the Allen spectrum of it, then from that you can get the size of the maximum computational subspaces. So thank you very much.
Then you also, so if you fail, there isn't a large subspace,
forward, but then you have to answer, I guess, Robin's question of can you efficiently access those qubits?
Yeah, if there's a large subset.
That's sort of important step one.
Yeah.
And rule out lots of things that won't work.
Yeah, so I mean, there is scaling differences in the amount of time it takes you to access different things, like in in this example, for example, it takes, to perform a single qubit gate takes order n steps.
Which n? Though? Just not the little.
The big n.
Number of qubits?
Yeah, and it's bigger.
But that's not, I mean,
computation. Oh, yeah, no, I know that's efficient. I know that's efficient, but I'm. Yeah, so it's just, it depends on the system.
In cases where it's bad,
to be honest, I haven't
even a well-formed question.
You can make one up, like, suppose that you've got something where you've got your two to the n-dimensional space, and one of your things is the shift operator on that, then it could take exponentially long to implement a particular unitary.
I guess in general there are unitaries that are pretty hard to implement. So I guess you want to can you efficiently implement an efficient unit, give you a decomposed unitary, is the blow up using your Hilbert space all around the world.
That depends on the system. So yeah, you can construct examples.
Slide, you had the spin chain, the very simple spin chain, which was
basically
universal, but the spin chain, which has got slightly threadbare, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is there a simple rough theoretic rule of thumb you can point to and say, well, clearly it's because the X,
yeah,
Y,
sure. I gave an example of this using the later on. Okay, so because these two basically are connected in a symmetric way to the rest of the graph, you know that there's some state on that you can't get out of, so there's some anti-symmetric state. And so if you have, say, a three-qubit state that's connected in some way to itself, these qubits might be joined together, but that doesn't help. If you have some set of qubits that's connected basically in a symmetric way to the rest of the graph, then there's always some state on that that you can't get out of. So essentially, you can come up with some entangled state that blocks you transferring data across that section. But equally, there's other states you can put on that you can actually do computation with. So like in this case, everything except for the 0, 1, -1, 0 state, you can use. So if you're starting one of the other states, or something like outbox or not, then you've got a qubit that you can use. So you don't necessarily lose a qubit or many qubits.
So why doesn't that apply to the global automorphism of the line with it? That's a symmetry, right? So I would think if you have like a symmetric state, you'd never get out of the symmetric under the symmetric.
Yeah, that's
on the left,
that's
right.
True. These two, basically what I'm thinking about is you've got local control at either end, and then global control in the middle.
Okay.
So it's just, in this you can't break the symmetry. So actually all it requires is that you can't address these two separately for it to break the universe out. But if you've local control at one or more both ends of this, then you break the symmetry.
So on the other hand, if you have control that's separate at the ends, but it's the same at both ends, then you have sort of symmetry.
Yeah, it's fine. And you lose basically one qubit.
Yeah.
We definitely see you said then that if there's two or more points with the same adjacency, essentially, then you're missing out on an intersymmetric subspace.
Yeah.
But you make your reverse it and say that if every point in the chain has different, has its own unique adjacencies, is it universal?
No, I don't think that's enough.
No.
I think if there's any automorphism of any non-trivial automorphism of the graph or part of the graph, that would be a symmetry, right, in Hamiltonian. So it's commutative and commutable. And probably you could construct graphs that where each individual vertex is kind of unique, but
yeah,
you look at sets of them, there's...
Yeah.
No, that's not right. I guess if each... No. Because it's not unique in terms of the number of things they connect to, but which ones they connect to. So if you commute them all. So like if you have the tetrahedron, for instance, each one of those is unique and in which of the other three it connects to. But if you could commute all of them together and assume all of the four of them connect to the same things outside.
You need to be careful that there's entangled states with the entire graph.
That's an issue, but I would think you could. Okay, maybe it's not on pattern.
I think you're...
Well, for tetrahedron, you can construct states that global rotations won't affect.
Exactly, that's the problem that has a symmetry.
And I think if you talk about symmetries of graph, it's not... There's only...
You have not to be states with that symmetry, but...
Okay.
That's I guess what you're saying.
But there always are, though.
Yeah.
So I think it seems like what you're looking at here are super selection rules. That you've got a set of generators, you've got a set of operations that generate an algebra. And you're saying if the commutant of that algebra is non-trivial, then there we know that there
yes.
is a sense of selection, which means there's some sort of a code for a noiseless degree of freedom in this that you
yeah.
can't disturb. Could you go over the tensor product thing again?
Basically, it doesn't, you're not actually, by checking the commutation, so the idea is that you're forming a particular basis to come up with this commutation relation. And basically, D doesn't pick up if there's a tensor product structure on the space. Because you're not actually checking that you can get from every state to every other state. What you're checking is that there's no stabilizer that doesn't get changed.
So, backing up even further, if there is a tensor product structure on within the operators?
Yeah, so I mean, you can make an example where you have all the local rotations you want. So you've got local rotations by two or three axes for each qubit, and you've no coupling. Now, there is no operator that commutes with those, except for the identity.
Right.
But it's not universal, because there's no coupling.
Okay. So, what's the formal difference? When you say there is a tensor product structure, is there a formal definition?
Yeah, so, well, okay, if you start...
Is this supposed to be a necessary and sufficient condition to not... have the preparational subspace be larger, because that's an example of where it's not.
If there is... then you should be able to get from any state to any other state.
Okay.
There's certain additional problems in that. I mean, you need two lock fights to do that. Because then one lock fight
Right. But
in that case, you have D that does compute.
So here's a potential counterexample. So obviously, an example of something that wouldn't be universal would be the Pauli operators, right? we know that that's computation.
Oh yeah, sorry. Okay. Yes.
You're going to say that does have a tensor product structure.
Sorry, what do you mean by operators? But you have these are Hamiltonians.
Well, if you're talking about Hamiltonians, so yeah, sorry, there's a distinction between Hamiltonians and just operators that can apply individually. So if it's a Hamiltonian, then the tensor product structure is sufficient. But with poly operators or something like that, they have a tensor product structure.
Are the omega j's necessarily Hamiltonians, or can I think of them as unitaries as well? Can I use this where the omega j's, your operators, are unitaries?
Yes.
Okay.
But then the tensor product structure isn't necessarily sufficient.
Oh, I see. If they're Hamiltonians,
has entanglement operators, no tensor product structure. But it only stabilizers.
So the Clifford group does not have a tensor product structure. I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, actually, that's a good.
Okay, so what's the definition of tensor product structure?
Well, basically, we want states that if the state can be written down. Okay, basically, what I mean by this is that if you have a state that starts as a tensor product, it ends as a tensor product. Of qubits in some basis.
Right. But presumably, we want to have a testable condition that we can write down for the control operator, the omegas, right? And I'm trying to, obviously that kind of works.
I don't think you could expect necessarily to be efficiently testable. Right? It could be tensor product structure on some really weird basis.
It doesn't
happen very often in interesting cases, but.
So it's not
that's essentially the case with linear optics again, because it's not obvious that so when you have indistinguishable particles, it makes a kind of weird tensor product structure where you can't where you can only access a certain subspace of it that you can do computation on.
That's a super selection rule, right? You get that gradation into the different number of particle states, but that's not a tensor product structure. I guess what I'm worried about is that this condition, the statement of a tensor product structure, is kind of trivial. I mean, if it's not testable, then it's like saying, well, here's this condition we can't test for that would screw up this process.
No, it's just, it might be hard to test. If somebody tells me this is a tensor product structure, at it and say, yes, these Hamiltonians don't interact with the tensor factor.
Are there any further questions? Not about tensor product structure. If not, then let's thank you again.